I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University, Australia, based here in Fremantle at the moment, Martin.
Indeed, indeed. And Australia is not a bad place to be, given everything that's going on other places. Sometimes isolation and distance is not such a bad thing.
I'm not sure how isolated we are, Martin. There are apparently two Australian sailors on the US sub that torpedoed the Iranian naval ship off Sri Lanka the other day. No one wants to talk about it. I haven't found out yet exactly which sub it was. I'll bet you anything you like. It's a nuclear-powered submarine that's probably already docked in HMAS Stirling, Garden Island, just south of Fremantle in the past few months, Martin.
Well, I think it'll be very interesting to hear a bit more about this. I think it was just today, wasn't it? The first time that it was admitted that there were Australian personnel on that ship that sunk the Iranian warship. So I expect there'll be a lot more questions posed about that and where we sit and our role.
Martin, this time last week, 7 days ago, when you and I recorded a view from the Roundhouse, the whole question was Iran. I recall, as listeners, regular listeners will, that I read to you some of the smart traveller warnings from the Australian government, and there just seemed to be a much more intense rhetoric around the fragile situation in the Middle East. Neither you nor I were going to be surprised if what has happened were to happen. I think that's a fair read. We're not trying to be wise after the event. Just the same, a day after we recorded this last week, kaboom, crash, Iran aided and abetted by Israel, or Israel aided and abetted by the US. Did I say Iran? The US, in they go. The missiles are flying. There are so many questions a week on, Martin. Do we know why President Trump hit the action button?
So this is one of the most confusing things. This is one of the greyest areas. So when he initially went in, he said this was about destroying the nuclear arsenal of Iran. And he hinted at climate, at regime change. Well, it's interesting because not only a few weeks beforehand, he was bragging about having destroyed Iran's nuclear stockpile. So that was a big about turn in and of itself. And the second one being regime change, he subsequently went cold on that because it was fairly apparent that despite having assassinated the regime's supreme leader, the regime at the moment, for the time being, is looking reasonably resilient. It doesn't seem to be much sign of people coming out in the streets, any form of organised resistance to the regime. Now, bear in mind, for the poor Iranians, they're getting bombed by Israel and the US, but only a month or 6 weeks ago, they were shot by their own security forces when they came out and tried to express resentment anyway. So they are really stuck between a rock and a hard place here, and they're in no position to do much at all. And I've spoken to Iranians that have family over there, Michael, and they haven't heard them back from them for months. So that's the second, the big issue here is what the actual objective is, because it doesn't seem to be very clear.
Martin, there are so many questions. You can fire in any direction, excusing the bad pun, and you're bound to hit something. I mean, one of the most terrible things that happened was in the first few days. It's increasingly seeming likely that it was the Americans' missiles that did it. 150 odd young elementary schoolgirls in a school in southern Iran were bombed and killed. Terrible. And you can't just say that's one of the things that happens in a war, can you?
Well, sadly, there's not too many wars where there's not civilians killed. That's why we try to avoid getting involved in these conflicts in the first place. Some of them might be unavoidable, where, say, Russia invades Ukraine or something like that. That's why everyone has a right to be asking the President of America, exactly why did you get involved in this conflict? Why did you start this latest phase of violence. And the other part of this too, Michael, is all of the other countries affected. So it's not just US and Israel, but gee, I mean, it's Bahrain, it's Qatar, it's the United Arab Emirates, it's Saudi Arabia, it's Turkey, it's Syria and Iraq, it's Azerbaijan, like all of these other countries involved now in this conflict in one way or another.
Martin, once upon a time, the rules, international law principles, how you waged and maintained wars and how you behaved during them applied, as we found out in Davos when Mark Carney, the Canadian PM, really blew the whistle on this loudly and clearly. Those rules don't seem to apply anymore. Once upon a time, you had to show there was an imminent threat before you could, in that sense, defend yourself. They're just everybody. Nobody suggests there was an imminent threat. You have to make this up in your own mind, don't you, if you believe it?
Well, Trump has suggested that there's an imminent threat. There's not been evidence brought forward to really underpin that. Certainly, we know that Iran has waged war through its proxies, particularly against Israel. But in terms of imminent threat, particularly in terms of imminent threat to the US, that's not been outlined. That's not been, there's not been unpacked. It's not said where and how they were going to attack the US. In what way? None of that's been articulated, and I think the part that is very interesting from here on in, Michael, that I'll be watching closely is how this war is seen domestically in the US, because that's the only yardstick I think that Trump really has in terms of limiting what he might try and do.
Martin, an aspect of that, of course, is that the US Congress has no say in all of this. The Democrats tried to force congressional oversight to basically give the president the authority to wage this war, and maybe they would have withdrawn any tacit support if they'd been able to. But really, it's the practical demonstration of the doctrine of might is right. You don't have any domestic controls in the US over the president. What he and his henchmen say goes. They've had to sack Kristi Noem, nothing to do with the war cabinet, but a proven maladministrator from her job in Homeland Security. You've got the Defense Secretary Hegseth there, who doesn't seem to know which way is up. Who's running this war? Trump's not going to sack himself. Probably he should. But how do you get any control over the biggest superpower on the planet when they don't abide by the rules of war, where the international law doesn't apply? Are we all just their pawn, Martin?
Well, because the problem with international law that we've known for some time is that who's enforcing it and who's really abiding by it? And if superpowers aren't abiding by it, then you can't really expect middle powers to. So unfortunately, it's not having any impact or influence in this stage. Ironically, Russia said, this is illegal. This is not in conjunction with international law. And I thought, oh, the irony. But it does show you the problem. You cite international law when it suits you, and you ignore it when it suits you when you're a great power. So that's part of the problem. There was a vote in Congress on this, and the Democrat attempt to provide oversight on this, particularly money, has fallen short 53-47, largely along party lines. But there's plenty of unease in the Republican Party about this as well. And I think it will only increase if they're not seeing any end to this.
One of the big questions which we've been discussing, Shipping News has touched on from time to time, even published an article some months ago now, which was quite prescient. If you didn't want to deal with the US, for example, because they keep imposing all of these crazy tariffs, how do you organise yourself with the rest of the world? It requires you to actually seek out and even have better relations with China, probably looking at the whole of Europe and the rest of the world. And I think we're back to doing that, aren't we? I mean, how does Australia, as a country which is powerfully in our minds, independent and always have been, don't want to be led by anybody, deal with this old best friend, the United States, when we plainly cannot rely on them anymore?
Yeah, it is a really tricky one, and I know that I think you had some correspondence during the week, Michael, about why Australia keeps backing the US. And that look, the long and short of it is Australia's joined at the hip with the US. We're part of the Five Eyes intelligence network, for instance, which means that, basically much of our intelligence gets shared with the US, and presumably they're sharing intelligence with us. And while we're not directly involved in this conflict in a traditional military sense, you can be sure that Australian intelligence contributed in some way, shape, or form ahead of time. You can the, most of our military hardware comes from the US. US has bases in prominent parts of Australia in strategic areas. We've got the ANZUS Treaty. Like, there are so many elements of this. And Australia's not really very well placed to separate ourselves from military objectives of the United States.
Well, Martin, here's a hypothetical for the Notre Dame students doing strategic studies, war and peace, international politics. What if Australia said, there's a little plug here just in Russell in Canberra, in the defence area there, and if we pull that plug out, there'll only be four eyes, there won't be five eyes, and our eyes won't be transmitting anything to the United States. What would happen?
Well, we've got some semblance about how these things might happen because Europe has started doing bits and pieces of this themselves. And Europe, Western Europe, in particular talking France and UK and Germany, they've been fairly long-standing allies of the US, and they've been very reluctant to endorse everything the US is doing. Now, they're all slightly different approaches from each of those countries. But it hasn't yet stopped Trump from doing what he wanted to do. And he's at the moment just responded with a degree of vindictiveness towards someone like Keith Starmer that hesitated when he was asked about supplying his bases. So I'm not sure that's worked for them. That doesn't mean that collectively, and Canada's another one, Michael. We haven't touched on that, but Prime Minister Carney was here from Canada. He has a warm relationship with our Prime Minister. And he's fairly bluntly said that Canada is not going to follow the US around on all scores. I should throw in one extra thing here when it comes to Australia's support for this action, even if they're concerned about the international law. Iran has orchestrated, according to Australian intelligence, Iran has orchestrated two attacks recently on Australian soil. And we recently expelled the Iranian ambassador. So there's no love lost between Australia's government and the Iranian government at the moment, anyway. So I think that they expressed some satisfaction with that from that point of view, even if I think privately they were concerned about the overall conflict and its approach.
When people on the street, Martin, have challenged me about all of this and why Australia seems to have taken that chance, I say everything's very, very simply explained by something called a by-election in Farrer, which isn't all that far away in about a month's time. What do you reckon?
Look, I'm not sure about that when it comes to Iran, and the reason is Labor won't stand in Farrer, and so they're not as directly impacted by this, that being the government party, but absolutely the coalition is, and the coalition's been making a lot of statements about immigration, but there's not a lot of difference between the Labor and Liberal positions on Iran at the moment. And I don't expect it to feature a lot in the Farrer by-election. I do expect immigration and perhaps some anti-Muslim statements to emerge in the Farrer by-election, perhaps from One Nation and other places. But I don't expect probably the conflict itself to be the key focus.
The difficulty, as I've seen it, is that if Australia is not seen in a even in a lukewarm way to be supporting the warmongering versus Iran for the reasons that you mentioned, that they'll be accused of being anti-Israel and a short step to anti-Semitic. It doesn't seem to me such a long bow to draw.
Well, I think that might They might have put more currency if it was a government-held seat they were afraid of losing. I think that this is the interesting one to watch in Farah is really the realignment of the right in Australian politics, and that will be fascinating to watch. You're going to have Liberal, National, and One Nation candidates running there. I saw a short interview. It was one on the ABC, Michael, where they interviewed supporters and likely candidates in Farah. That was very interesting to watch. And the thing that's really struck me from the vox pops on the street is just general dissatisfaction with the major parties and feeling completely neglected.
So the candidate we, in that sense, quietly don't mention is the independent community candidate.
Yeah, she certainly featured in that one, and she seemed to have quite a bit of support. There was she was out in Deniliquin and other places. She didn't poll quite as well in last time, and there seemed to be some momentum for her. Very difficult with vox pops, and it's not a scientific sample, Michael, but that was the general sentiment, was that people were just unhappy with politics as usual.
Martin, I just love saying over and over and over and over again, Deniliquin. Isn't that a beautiful, beautiful name?
Beautiful name.
Martin, the best quote I've come up with at the moment from all of this stuff going around Iran is one from J. Caspian King, who writes for the New Yorker magazine. Just this morning, he talks about the Trump administration's policy of shoot first and don't ask questions later. It's a good one, isn't it?
Well, the fascinating thing is, of course, they're in the middle of negotiations when this happened, and literally the prominent Qatari leader that was he was actually arrived in the US and started talking about how much progress the negotiations were made. And I think that was the day before the bombing started. So, I mean, that was quite extraordinary timing too.
I haven't seen anybody, they probably have already done this, engage in an analysis about Trump when he was making his money as a real estate guy and running that television show that I've never seen, sacking people, handled those negotiations. There will have been a point, I'm sure, where in the course of negotiations, he laid down a big marker. And if you're not going to do this, I'm walking out the door and I'm taking the telephone and I'm taking the briefcase and I'm also going to put a skunk through the front door of your house. He makes the threats. The negotiations don't work out the way he wants. And he just has to, out of some sense of self-respect, throw the skunk through the front door. He has to hit Iran here. They weren't playing the game according to his rules in negotiating quickly. So he had to do it. Am I plausible?
Yeah, well, I think that's the diplomacy through military strength approach, Michael, where you predicate the success of your negotiation around your asymmetric strength as opposed to your opponent. It's the stick approach. And if you're going to carry a big stick, you do have to use it occasionally.
Well, I have to say, I think there's a fair bit of that in it. But I've also wondered this. The aforementioned J. Caspian King made reference to the policy of shoot first and don't answer questions later, which he thought might be a conscious effort to circumvent or perhaps even erase the country's collective memories of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And in fact, when I first heard about the bombing that they'd gone in last Saturday, the way they did, it struck me there was something else people were forgetting. I was in Canada in 1979, and it was just around then that the things all started happening in Iran. The American hostages were taken. The Americans have never quite gotten over that. And I can't help but think there was just a simple desire when they had the chance to really bloody nose the kid in the playground.
I think that's a there's some interesting analogies there. I still think there's a lot of analogies with Iraq in 2003, the weapons of mass destruction and the nuclear program that Iran's that being the predication for both conflicts. Of course, people will point out that Iran do have some form of nuclear facilities. I'd point out that only a year ago, Trump claimed to have destroyed them all. So I think that was they're the similar excuses that we've got. The one big concern of Trump, I would have thought, is to make sure it's not a repeat of Iraq. There's one other development in the last couple of days, and I don't know if this is a good or bad development, was that some of the Kurds in the very northern part of Iran are talking about charging in on the ground, and then him providing cover for them. Well, that could go well or it could go incredibly badly. If he's promising to provide cover and then that drags on for weeks or months, where does that leave him?
Well, your discussion of Iraq, of course, takes us all back to it. Many of us knew, I'd say more than a majority, that there was never any plan B for Iraq. They were hoping they'd find all of these weapons of mass destruction. They didn't. But they never really thought through, once they moved in, toppled the big statue, how they were going to manage the place. And the warlords turned up and started to run it. Not a whole lot different in Afghanistan. I mean, what thought has really gone into this? The Shah's son is not going to get the job. And if he did, well, the world would have retrograded by, 60, 70, 80 years, Martin.
I think there's a lot of unanswered questions there. How do you actually topple a regime that's far more deeply entrenched than what we saw in Iraq? How do you try to create a new, well, maybe democracy, maybe not, we'll see, in a nation that is, it's about, I think it's about three times the size of Iraq, and it's a lot bigger and more complex than Afghanistan. So it's the job and the task would be enormous here, and I mean, people think Iraq's solved. Iraq's still a very fragile democracy with a lot of militias running around, remnants of ISIS and other places, Kurdish autonomous areas. It's not a settled place even now. Of course, Afghanistan, and infamously, the Taliban re-emerged and came straight back in 20 years later. So these things are not just settled by regime change.
It's very popular for a range of politicians to talk about the terrorists, the people running Iran, and of course, all of the proxy regimes that you've mentioned around the Middle East as terrorists, and no doubt a number of them are and are prescribed as such in Australia. But doesn't something like this war just breed the next generations? I use the plural purposefully of terrorists.
Well, that is part of the complication. Every time there's a war, there's probably people growing up, living under bombs and resenting that, losing family members and having more angst and more stress and perhaps more hatred towards those that did it. So, that's part of the story of this part of the world, is that it has been a place of conflict and the resentments that build up around that conflict endure.
Well, Martin, I don't think we're any more certain this week, the strikes having happened, as to what's going to happen in the next week. One view of things is they're all going to run out of missiles, one perhaps sooner than the other. The Americans are still trying to spot exactly where the missiles are coming from, it seems, to try and wipe out the launches. The drones are turning out to be much more effective than anyone had actually counted on. They seem to be able to land them with a great degree of accuracy here, there, and everywhere. Will Trump just withdraw and say, "Well, there you are. I've taught him a lesson, and the midterms are on, and I'm a great hero"?
I think there's a real possibility of this, that somewhere 3, 4, 5 weeks in, which is the rough time frame he provided previously, that he claims victory and stops and says, I've taken out all the nuclear facilities, I've taken out all the major military installations, I've destroyed their navy, and victory to me.
Martin, I'm exhausted. Don't know what's going to happen. You probably do. I know you're just not sharing it. But we're going to have to return next Friday morning to not to reprise this, but to see if we're any the wiser. Do you think we will be?
Not much. I suspect we'll have some developments to talk about. Like I said, there may well be a somewhere like a 4 to 6 week time frame for Trump that he's looking to contain this within. So we're likely to see some more reports. We'll be interested to see how many different countries are brought into this, if there's any more development in terms of on the ground offensives. Like I said, what's the domestic position in the US on this, which will be interesting to watch, and whether there is indeed any movement in Iran around the regime.
Martin, on that note, thank you very much for joining me. This, even though it sometimes we sound a little jocular, or perhaps I do, in putting questions and raising issues, this is one of the most significant things to have happened, I think, in the last number of decades.
Very significant. And look, the worst case scenario, which we've not got yet, is that Iran leads on someone like Russia or China to get involved. And Russia was fielding questions around this and saying, well, we've not been asked. But that would be the worst case scenario. You wouldn't want to see that happen and it gets escalated further.
That would be World War III, Martin.
Well, that's the nightmare scenario.
Martin, thanks for joining me today. Let's hope we have a more peaceful week this coming week than the last week we've just endured, albeit from afar.
Absolutely.